The following presentation was recorded at the 1997 Teachers Workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Excellent discussions we've had so far. However, you may find a few areas where I overlap or where I reinforce some of the things that have been said. First of all, I'd like to read a few paragraphs about the life of a great scientist, even though he wasn't honored as such at first. It was in the back of the barber shop where a youthful apprentice was combing out the white silken strands of a gentleman's wig. Mounted on a wooden headpost, he paused and looked up quickly as he heard the sound of footsteps. It was his uncle, the master barber surgeon. And what the uncle came to tell him was that he'd been accepted as an apprentice surgeon at the Hotel Dieu, which was the hotel or the hospice of God in Paris. This was in the 1500s because Ambrose Paré was born in 1510. He was no stranger to the hospital where he was called to help. He often worked there as an apothecary boy, assisting in whatever tasks the surgeons had asked of him. But now he needed to assist one of the master surgeons who was ministering to the sick in the city of Paris. The hospital had 1,200 beds. More than one-third of these were for single patients. This doesn't mean they were unmarried, it just meant one patient per bed. Larger beds, 5 feet wide, occupied by 3 to 6 patients each. There was no separation according to kinds of illness or any other reason for that matter. A single bed might contain a man with a broken leg, a woman in childbirth, an infant in convulsions, a young man burning with fever, a middle-aged woman with tuberculosis, and maybe even a corpse that had been dead for 24 hours and hadn't been removed yet. In one section of the hospital, there were special beds for children, 8 beds, which held 200 babies and children. Those who had beds were fortunate. Many patients lay on piles of straw in the large halls. The straw was seldom changed, and it crawled with lice and cockroaches and other insects. There was no light or ventilation. A little ventilation would even help us, wouldn't it? Is the fan on? 1 out of every 5 patients died. Among the surgical cases, there was almost no survivors. On the morning of the appointment, Ambrose Paré was taken to the hospital by his uncle. In the outer hall, they met 2 commissioners of the Council of 8 who had signed his appointment. The commissioner shook his hand warmly and welcomed him in the name of God and the King. Monsieur Pierre, we know that you will one day become one of the great surgeons of France. Ambrose bowed his head. Humbly thank you, gentlemen, for your confidence. Oh, I'm sure, but now, Monsieur le Docteur, he needs you. Ambrose turned to the waiting surgeon who came silently into the hall. I'm glad you've come, the servant said. I've been saving a case which is just right for your talents. But hurry, the man will not live an hour longer. Ambrose shook hands with the man. Goodbye, he said to his uncle. Now, every time I get myself a good apprentice, I lose him, he said gruffly as he left. Ambrose followed the surgeon silently down the hall. At the entrance to the hall, they picked up a sponge from the table, dipped it in some vinegar, and held it to their nose to overcome the stench of the room. Now, this was the custom because the air could not be endured suddenly coming in from the out of doors. Each attendant practiced this upon entering the hospital. In a dim basement hall, they came upon a wretched patient who had been lifted from his pile of straw and tied to an operating board. Ambrose Paré groaned within himself when he saw the man. His broken leg was twisted, showing the white stumps of bone through the flesh, a compound fracture. "You will operate. It'll be above the knee. Now quickly." Other patients watched from the huddles of straw with sick, expectant eyes. Nearby, a monk fanned the white flame of the brazier and turned the cauterizing iron to heat it evenly. The knife and the saw lay beside the patient. I'll omit the next several paragraphs, but the patient died. Well, one of the most famous things that happened was in 1536 at this same place. The King of France, with a great army, was fighting. Many cities and many castles were taken. And there the captain of the French army, Leyrat, was taken with an arquebus shot through the ankle, wherewith he suddenly fell to the ground. And in the journal of the time, Ambrose Paré wrote, "Now the rat is taken, but I dressed his wound and God healed him." That last sentence has been one of the most famous sentences in medical science in the history of the world. "I dressed his wounds and God healed him." Now what happened was this. Up until this time, they felt that the way to take care of a gunshot wound was to pour in boiling oil, because you had to neutralize the gunpowder. But gunpowder was poisonous, and very few people survived the treatment of the time. And the thing was that Ambrose Paré ran out of oil. There wasn't enough. And so he dressed his wound, and what he said was this. "The best dressing he could think of was stirring up the yolks of eggs and oil of roses and a bit of turpentine. He applied this to the wounds and dressed them up with good bandages. But he didn't sleep at all that night. He was worried about the poor soldiers. He was not able to treat them properly because he had nothing to neutralize the gunpowder. And he was astonished the next morning when he found that those that were treated with the burning oil were inflamed and restless and very sore. And those he had not treated with the burning oil had little feeling of pain, and their wounds were without inflammation, and they rested well." Now, then Ambrose writes, "I resolved with myself never more to burn thus cruelly poor men wounded by gunshots." It didn't matter what the book said now. His own observations had showed him that the books were wrong. He went on to design making artificial limbs, eyes they couldn't see, but they give the impression of an eye. He performed operations for cleft palate, and also he made it much easier for childbirth with a set of obstetrical pliers of some sort, and saved the lives of many mothers and children. I talked to a gynecologist. He's on his deathbed now. He's 98 years old. And I asked him what was the most important thing he's ever done in his life. He said, "I've saved the lives of 10,000 mothers and 100,000 children." Now, this is the kind of science that somehow is applied science, isn't it? Applied science. Now, first of all, I'd like to reinforce a few of the things we've heard by asking a question. I'd like for your responses. What is science after all? We've had science demonstrated, explained, and so on, but in concluding all of this, and summarizing what is science after all.
Knowledge.
That's what the word means. It's to know. And this is only possible with consciousness. Consciousness. We must be aware of something or we can't learn, right? We must be aware of all the possibilities that surround the immediate question. We must be conscious of ourselves. The famous old saying, I think, therefore I am, is really important here because we cannot know what we're not conscious of, right? Am I wrong? Can you know something that you're not conscious of? Now, some people talk about intuition. Some people having a sixth sense, or seventh, or eighth, or ninth, or tenth. Even sometimes tenth sense is coming in. Now this word is used twice in the King James Bible, once in the book of Daniel, once in the New Testament, and it has to do with this idea of being aware of what's going on. Now, with the one you have a negative connotation, science falsely so-called. And the reason for that is, the Greeks were not sure about the existence of God and matter. They didn't even know a thing about time, really. And those are big subjects. In fact, you could take the rest of the day discussing just what the Greeks thought about matter. Understand me? But this is the basis of knowing what is there, what is real. The Greeks looked at this problem, what exists, what is? What is? What is? What is? Is it strange to you that God spoke to Moses and said, I am? What does that mean in our language? I was, I will be, perpetually I am. God is always in the is position. All right? The Greeks didn't know this. The Greeks didn't know this. They also had a problem of what is true, what is beautiful, what is real. And there are many scientists today still have a problem with this. They've never come to grips with the idea that somewhere not only is there a power from which all of this descends and develops, but that power is, and he's with you, he's in you. Well, what do you think Christ meant in Luke 17:20 when he said, the kingdom of God is within you? Does that make any difference to you as a Christian? That the kingdom of God is within you, and he's in your classroom, he's in your science class, he's even in the science class when Johnny sticks his tongue out at you. God is there in Johnny with his tongue out, because God is in everyone. Now maybe you never saw a little boy do that, but you felt like it sometimes yourself already, didn't you? How about little girls? Do they do that too? Tell me about it. All right. What is true? What is beautiful? What is real? I'm glad that I can confess today that I believe by faith, we believe, we understand, we know that the things are created, were created by a power that is still powerful. He never slackened. When he said, let there be light, it didn't lose anything from himself. When I burn a candle, it does. Whether it's frozen or not. But when God said, let there be light, let there be matter, let there be energy, let there be all of this, God is absolutely the same. We understand that the worlds were framed by the, what's the word? Word of God. The Word of God. Now, what does all this have to do with applied science in the classroom? Well, my dear brother, my dear sister, whoever else happens to be here, unless we're clear on it, we're just like the Greeks. Now, here's another problem. If there's a God, if there's a God, and he speaks down to earth, that's one thing. But if you have people on earth reaching out for God, what do you have? You have the sum total of all Oriental religions. If you want to study them, you may, but they'll give you a headache, in my estimation. What we're striving to find out is someone out there. Oh God, if there is a God. That's a terrible prayer to pray. But unless we're clear on it, we will wind up being a humanist, beginning from our point of view, and I don't care how you do it. If we're a humanist, we're a humanist. God wants us to be humane, he wants us to be human, but he wants to reflect himself in us on earth. Thy kingdom come where? On earth, as it is in heaven, right? We're not talking about a cloudy cuckoo land out there on the other side of cloud 17. These people are looking for that. And again, I don't care how nice they are, how polite they are, how cultured they are. If they don't know God, excuse me, I don't mean to insult any of you who happen to be in that shape. Clever devils. Some Christian day schools turn out these kind of pupils. The worst enemies to truth are the people who know all the right answers, but they don't know God. And we science teachers are sometimes accused of being on the worldly end of things. Now let me warn you. There's such a thing as religious humanism, just like there's such a thing as secular humanism. Are you clear on that yourself? You cannot apply science in the classroom unless that's dedicated to the glory of God and to the good of our fellow man. I make no apologies. Science without God is demonic. Did you hear that this morning? Or yesterday somebody talked about the people in Germany, I saw people who came from the concentration camps with the tattoos on their arms. And some of their friends were dragged out and their leg muscles were cut off and other muscles sewed in so they could take that muscle and put it on a German soldier to get him back on the battlefield. We had a brother in our church that survived that kind of thing. When they tried to use chicken skin on his legs so they would heal faster. Well, we know now that pig skin is better than chicken skin. And there's a plastic material they use that's better than either. But applied science comes as a result of knowing what you have to apply. Now, also this morning, or today, or several times, there's been something referred to. I think we should underscore it here. It's called the scientific method. Now, what does this mean? Because science is to know, and it's also something else. It's a way to find out. And a number of times speakers have referred to the five steps. Can anyone tell me what they are? First, we begin with a problem. And I know different writers have a different way of maybe putting these in line, but we always begin with a question. My bunnies are dying, Brother Tucker. Okay, go on, do your math. No, my bunnies are dying. That's all right. We have too many bunnies anyway. A problem. And as you noticed in what I said, there's a multi-problem in that case. A problem of communication. A problem of rapport. As well as bunnies dying. And if you ever had a bunny to die, and it was your pet, you know what a problem that is. What's the next step then, as you remember it? No, we're not quite ready for that yet. That's the way it was mentioned, but I want to clarify that.
What's,
okay, we usually, yeah, let's get all the information we can about it. And here is where we sometimes trip, isn't it? Because depending on what we state in the problem, we will come up with data that is not to the point. There's an interesting book you might find in the public library, How to Lie with Statistics. And this is one kind of data that is often used. I'll just use one example. Did you know that 50% of all the medical doctors are in the lower half of their class in school? Did you know that? Okay. Now, after we have the data, what's so strange about that? Even if you put them in alphabetical order, you're going to have a top and a bottom of the class, aren't you? So the data itself does not speak to the point. Now, here's where we put our hypothesis. And by the way, this is a guess of the college education, is really what a hypothesis is. And then what do we do with this? Then we try to prove it. And then what do? Back before my hypothesis, we tried to prove our hypothesis. If it doesn't work, what do? We re-examine the data, make a new hypothesis, move again. Right? But what I'm saying here is, if God is not in the picture when we make the problem, how's he going to get in the rest of the time? He's not in the habit of kicking his way in. Did he kick into your life that way? Then down here's some proof. And we read this, this is a long process. Then what comes next?
Conclusion.
You make a conclusion, you try to find out what does this amount to? We conclude it. This equals this. And then there's one other fact I think we should remember, and that's the thing of falsification. You have to prove that this is right by trying to prove that it's wrong. This is why you have all these tests on drugs before they're given to people. If you want to know how that works, check the thalidomide story of World War II, when one lady in our country blocked it, and this was not used as a tranquilizer, but it was used in Germany, and so many, many babies were born without brains and arms and legs and all this kind of thing as a result of this thalidomide thing. But it was not used in our country. The nearest thing that was used here was what was sprayed in Vietnam on the landscape to kill everything, this Agent Orange, and its chemical structure is almost like thalidomide. So we have the thing occurring in Vietnam now, a generation, two generations later, of many, many malformed children as a result of Agent Orange and Agent Blue, as well as the results on American soldiers and others that were exposed to this. Now, I'd like to put this process to work here, if I could. I don't know if I have enough of these, but I'd like for these teachers to get these. If you can somehow, I asked them about how many of these, so I think there's 50 copies. Applied science. This is applied science. You may share, if you like. We could make a few more if we need to, but I think for sake of time, we'll just share with your neighbor, however we can do it. Make them go as far as they can. And you'll see a whole bunch of lines on this paper. And it doesn't make sense, does it? Does it? And that's the way many of the problems in life are, right? They don't make sense. How can we make sense? Well, I must explain something. Point number one. This is a sentence. Point number two. It's a proverb that once you know it, you'll probably know it the rest of your life. It's a very simple thing. But this is the way we come to our children in the classroom. They don't know a thing about what we're thinking. You know, they don't know a thing about what we're thinking. It might be gerunds. It might be science. It might be some math. They don't know a thing about it. It's just a bunch of lines to them. Now, would it help if I told you something about that sentence? Well, if I told you, for example, did you ever get lost in your notes? If I told you that there are 20 vowels in this sentence, not counting any I's, there's no I's. And if I told you there are 43 consonants, I'm supposing you know what a vowel is and a consonant is, aren't I? I mean, there's some presuppositions. To learning, we always presuppose something. We begin at a place. We don't begin at the conclusion, we begin at the beginning. To apply science in your teaching, we must begin where the pupil is. Now still, as you look over this, it doesn't make sense, does it? I told you there are 20 vowels, not counting any I's. That means there's A's, E's, O's, U's, but no I's. Now I don't care how you pronounce them. You can even be from Canada and pronounce them how you want them. Consonants, there are 43 consonants. And I didn't take the time. Yes, I did. I took the time to find out the ones that were missing. And we have to eliminate F, J, K, Q, S, X, and Z. And the others occur in from 1 to 8. Does that help you? That's the data. Did you ever play a game like this before? We've been playing it all our life. Every time you come up against a new problem, you go through this process. Here's the problem. Well, what's the data? The data is there's 20 A's, E's, O's, U's. There's 43 consonants, not counting F, J, K, Q, S, X, and Z. It's a fun game, isn't it? Well, now, let me give you another paper if I can have somebody help me here. Here is a list of all the consonants in their proper place. You get that one? See, I applied the oil to his wound. I learned something in the process, just like Ambrose Bierce did. If you know where the consonants are, then all you have to do is figure out the vowels. Well, that should be much easier, shouldn't it? That's why it sure still won't make sense. Because you know where to put them, right? What's another thing you have to know in order to put the vowels in the correct place? I mean, the consonants in the correct place. Well, there's certain rules about the use of consonants, aren't there? Did anybody study phonics? That's a science. They tell me it is anyway. They tell me reading is a science. Well, let me give you another one, and this will be the clincher. I'll give you the list with the vowels. That might work. Now, isn't this the way we teach the children in school? We go from what they know to what we want them to know. And in the meantime, we insert what we think they ought to know. Now that sounds pretty simple, but this to me, educational psychology is a difficult science. But unless we work on it partly at least part, would you like to help us out with this? Give a little exercise here after lunch. We'll call a few calories. And you'll find there's a very interesting little proverb here. Once you get it all put together. But you may like to try something like this in a simpler vein with your students sometime. I won't vouch for the truth of the proverb. I'm just stating that I think it's accurate. One never can tell the depth of the well by the length of the handle on the pump. And I think that you'll find that to be accurate observation. Now, in addition to this research method, we also have in science, moving hurriedly on, we also have in science a technical method, and that was outlined by some of the brothers today, where you give to the pupil the technical method as opposed to the research. This is based on deductive reasoning. And this is based on inductive reasoning. Is this correct? Anybody here have studied this in depth? You can help me out. Research method is based on inductive reasoning. And this is on deductive. And after you work this problem and prove your hypothesis, then you can move it over to this position and use it for deductive reasoning. Is this correct? Now, I'll basically tell you the difference. Deductive reasoning is based on certain hypotheses or statements. And the result is no more true than the original premise is true. The Greeks were clever at this. And this is why Greek wisdom fails down. If you don't falls down. Read Paul, for example. He digs into Greek wisdom with tooth, claw, and nail. And it's based on deductive reasoning. First of all, they said nothing exists, one group said. Another group said everything is eternal. And this is shown up in your science books in this statement. Matter and energy can neither be created nor destroyed. How many have ever heard that in science? Is it true? Now, is it true? Would it be better to say it is not in the power of man to create or destroy energy and matter? Wouldn't that be better? Because when I'm saying the matter cannot be destroyed, that means never ever before and never ever after. But if I'm going to believe in creation and make it practical to my pupils, then I'm going to have to somehow understand that my basic premise is crap. I'll give you another educational psychologist when he said that learning is the focalization of our consciousness on a thing to be automatized, plus attentive repetition, allowing no exceptions to occur until automatism results. Isn't that nice? That's what he said. But yet, what we have automatized is no more true than our basic premise is true. If I'm a firm believer in the flat earth theory, I'll teach science from the flat earth theory. A man said to me here a couple years ago, he said, women are too stupid to do such and such and such. Whew! That's a subject I'm not going to argue. So I said, listen, mister, just a minute. Suppose your church is going to have a dinner, and suppose you want potato salad, and you want six women to make potato salad, and you give them all the same recipe, but what are you going to have when you come to the dinner? Six kinds of potatoes. Same with baked beans. Two people down the road can't make the same baked beans with the same recipe. Why? Are they stupid? I don't think. Something else. Another idea is this. This occurs in our own history, and we fought it tooth, claw, and nail. I like Mennonite history. And one of the things they fought tooth, claw, and nail, in fact, they went overboard with it in Holland, was Jesus is God, right? Mary was his mother, right? Therefore, Mary is the mother of God, right? Now, both of those statements are true, absolutely true. Jesus is God, right? Mary is the mother of Jesus, right? Therefore, Mary is the mother of God. And this is based on Greek deductive reasoning, a syllogism we call it. And this must be clear in our mind that we know what we're investigating, or we're going to come out on the other side of Robin Hood's barn stuck in the mud. Believe me. And this is one of the reasons why many a young person has lost his moorings in Christian faith. He wasn't sure of the premises. He wasn't sure of the premises upon which his whole argument was based. Deductive reasoning can be very useful. And in fact, when we get down to this point, we use it. There must be much data here. Must be much data. A boy came to my desk one day and he said, "Do you know that goldfish don't like molasses bread?" "Well, what's molasses bread?" "Oh, you put molasses on bread and eat it." "Oh, yeah, okay. But goldfish don't like it." "How do you know?" He said, "I put some on bread and I made an experiment. I threw it in a goldfish tank and they all died." "Well, maybe they would have died anyway." And he didn't say how often he fed them even goldfish food. So just that one observation. It'd be like the man going through a tunnel and a fella came up through the train selling bananas and he bought one and he went blind, you know? Well, that's the problem. Just base it on a little bit of data. There are three things I'd like to insert right here about applying science in the classroom, or applied science rather than just technical research science. Point number one, know your material. And you can underscore and circle and star the word know. Know your material. If you're a teacher, particularly, there's no excuse for a teacher saying, "I haven't had time to study this material. You do the first three questions and tomorrow I'll help you with them." I'm a firm believer that the teacher should be prepared. And I know the teacher's caught up short sometimes, especially if you have to double up classes because of an emergency or because there's an emergency in your family or something. You know, I understand that. We're all caught in a bind. But, you know, it's sort of like the guy on Sunday who says, "My ox was in the ditch. My ox was in the ditch." Well, it's time to get rid of the ox or fill up the ditch if it happens too many times. And that's the way it is for the teacher. If he's falling back on this old argument that, my mother-in-law just gonna fly to Europe and I had to take her to New York. That shouldn't happen too often. You know. I mean, I don't care how often you send your mother-in-law to Europe. I don't care about that. But it shouldn't happen at the expense of your students. Point number two, know your material. First, know your material. Now, know your material. Zero in on what you're supposed to be doing. We had a lot of information on method. That's it. If you want it to be applied to your students, you want to be applied in the classroom, not only do you need to know the content, you must know the method. And you all know, I'm not telling you a thing new, there's a wrong way to go about a right thing. And there's right ways to go about a right thing, right? Whatever you use the pliers for is probably wrong. Did you ever hear a mechanic tell you that? Whatever you use the pliers for is probably wrong. There's a lot of pliers business in teaching. And it can get you in a lot of trouble. Thirdly, know your pupil. Know your pupil. This is very important. Now, one little example can be to know your pupil, how they think and how they reason. It's a little quiz like that, maybe. Or the other is about their observation. I'm quite sure you're all familiar with this thing, but I'll demonstrate it once again so you will have a chance. I'm making two lines the length of this eraser. And they're within reasonable tolerances, they're the same length as this eraser. But all I need to do is add some other lines, and they appear to be different. And you know I use the same eraser for my straight line. Now what makes them appear to be different? Well, this happens when you're talking to something to little Johnny and Mary and Susie in class too. You think, I have that line straight. It's right there. Johnny sees this one, Mary sees this one. Now sometimes it's our shades that need straightening up. But more often there's something behind the shades that needs straightening, and that is we didn't tell them exactly what to look for. I found this in biology many a time, that I hadn't quite explained what are you supposed to look for down in there. When I told my students that this earthworm had a gizzard, why, they were thinking about a chicken gizzard. Because that's what the word meant. Well, it performed the same function to the earthworm, of course. Now, I must hurry along. As we've heard, there's biological science, physical science. There's also social sciences. We must be aware of them. I don't think that a teacher should teach social studies without some awareness of anthropology and ethnology. I don't see how you can teach English without an awareness of linguistics of some sort. And if you have no other access than the public library and the Oxford dictionary to the English language, you can at least find the origin of words that we commonly use, and some that are found in the translations of the scripture we use, and some that are found in the songs we sing, that we don't have any idea what we're talking about. But if we're going to teach the subject, we should be able to sort this out. In biology, for example, which has been my major field of interest over the years, next to history perhaps, there's a lot of things. For example, endocrinology is a very new field. The study of endocrines is a very new field, and it's very important. I was just reading this past summer several books on the subject. The use of these chemical catalysts inside of a person to speed up and slow down chemical reactions within yourself. And one thing talked very pointedly to me was this gentleman. He was an endocrinologist himself, and his aunt was having trouble. She didn't get out of her chair for a week. Can you imagine the situation? The old lady sat in her chair for a week. She didn't eat. She didn't, I don't know how she slept or whatever. She was in absolute filth and all that. And they took her to the hospital, and right away, she has Alzheimer's disease. Well, as an endocrinologist, he said, I would like to have a thorough profile on the endocrines. And they found out her thyroid was not functioning, which is a normal thing for older people. It's not an abnormal thing for older people's thyroid not to work well. In 2 weeks, the old lady was back to taking care of her house, taking care of her lawn and her garden, the same way she had before. Now, that doesn't work every time. But there's too many times people have been pushed off into a corner because they were not aware of the chemical imbalance in their system. This also happens to us mentally. Our brain makes a number of chemicals, and they're in balance normally. So we get excited, and then our body automatically adjusts to the other side and neutralizes this thing. So we're kept in a homeostasis, an equilibrium, that we can think, and we can think well normally. But sometimes there are individuals, like a sister told me not so long ago, she said, I make too much serotonin, and so I have this to contend with. Another person says, I make the other, I'm depressed all the time. You know, well, sometimes we feel like we like to jump in a hole and pull the hole in after us. This is a normal reaction to some problems in life, especially if we've been really embarrassed by something. But we soon adjust to it. We soon adjust to it. The biochemistry of our body is an absolutely fantastic thing. This is one place where when I talk to a person who believes in the happen-so origin of things, just asking not only the function of the eye, for example, color in the eye. It's a chemical change. It takes place every time you see something of another color. Your body's constantly making these changes, back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And we're able to live productive lives and think and move and do. Even Darwin himself said, there were when he talked to Lyell or one of Lyell's representatives about the time of so-called evolution, Darwin said, "No, I said, you don't have enough time. You don't have enough time. Time is the element there. See, time. Give me enough time and I'll take a hydrogen atom and have it evolve into a helium atom. Give me enough time. Enough lightning strikes and then a few other things, like Dr. Miller out at University of California is supposed to have done. I read over his results. They sound very plausible. He's supposed to have come up with a form of an amino acid or a precursor of an amino acid. And then the rest of the story went silent. And the point was, it had to be removed immediately or the toxins would have destroyed it. That can't happen in your body. And all you have to do is hold an infant in your hand and look at the hand of that infant. Just the hand. Discard all the rest of the baby. Just hold his hand. And you'll be amazed at the ability of their hand to do things from day to day. And it happened. Sure, it happened, but it had a grand design behind it. Or take your hand right now. The ability to do that right there, no other living creature on the face of the earth can do what you and me. Right there. The opposable thumb. Now, how does this apply in the classroom, everyday life, applied science? Science is not a cloudy, ethereal something way out here in yonder cuckoo land. Neither is it just a bag of tricks, but it's regular everyday living. You are a dynamo of energy. You are a dynamo of energy that's doing things in every cell of your body. And the moment you quit doing things, what happens? You begin to die, right? So we are. We're dying all the time. We're regenerating new cells all the time. Most of them, some of them not. But one of the most remarkable things is that memory you have. And if the cells of your body change, you can still remember over and over and over. Now, it's true, reinforcement establishes memory. That's right. But I do not believe, in my heart, I do not believe it's possible to take a goat and get him to have a memory beyond the goat of the memory of a normal goat. Now, you know what I mean. Now, his brain may look like yours, and you may act like him. but to make another situation, I'm afraid if it did, it'd be a Frankenstein's monster. I'm afraid it would. Or the matter of conscience. Has your conscience ever really bothered you about something? Did you ever wonder about the psychology of your conscience? What's going on? Well, is it the right hemisphere of my brain or the left hemisphere? Is it down here under my blood pump? Bloop, 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 bloop. Is that where it is? It's understandable that the ancients thought about the heart as the center of affection, isn't it? Now, the Eskimos didn't. To them, it's the liver. So they translate, "Let not your heart be troubled," to actually, "Let not your liver quiver." So that, to them, that makes sense. Because to them, "Let not your heart be troubled" means nothing. So in the Eskimo translation, that's the way you do it. But your conscience, the little part of you that says, hey, buddy, you did something you shouldn't have done. Your conscience will seldom stop you from doing something, but it'll surely tell you when you've done it. What accounts for that? Is it air? Is it atoms of carbon, and even molybdenum, or something else, some rare earth? Is that what makes our conscience work? Is it because our ancestors got tired living in the salty ocean, so they said, let's live on earth, so they jumped out? And finally they got into trees? Two monkeys were sitting in a coconut tree, and one said to the other, there happens to be a rumor that can't be true that man descended from our noble race. Why, the very idea is rank disgrace. You never saw a monk build a fence around a tree and leave his coconuts go to waste, forbidding others to take a taste? And on it goes. Yes, man descended, he said, but not from us. Now, I know we sometimes poke fun at the evolutionists, but listen, there are some serious scientists out there, and they're working with what they have to work with from the basis that they stand. Now, you might like mustard on your ice cream, but from the basis where I stand, I don't like it. You may, from where you stand. And if you're always brought up to eat horseradish on your apple pie, and you like that, fine. I have no objection, but count me out. Not that I don't like apple pie, not that I don't like horseradish, but the combination kind of irks me about something. How do we learn? We go from the known to the unknown, as I mentioned before. We go from the simple to the complex. It's always that way. When we try to give a child a very complex concept and he hasn't had the simple concept first, we're wasting our time. Leslie Culver at our last Teachers Institute told about his daughter, who was on a accelerated education course, and she was just heads and tails way above everybody else. And the teacher just left her go until she got to a certain place where the math was way beyond her, and she started to get failing grades. She missed some of the steps that were important to understand that. I think it's important that we get those steps in. Scope and sequence is important, not just because it's convenient for the teacher, but it must be on the step the child can understand. A number of ways that we can apply this, as I mentioned, social studies. Science applies in social studies very much, especially you talk about transportation. Where can you talk about transportation nowadays without talking about science? Communication, food preservation. Probably all of us are wearing some man-made fibers today. That applies in social studies. Well, even music. It's like I was telling a brother here yesterday. If there's a certain number of vibrations for A flat, and you have one too many or one not enough, you don't have A flat. You have something else. Isn't that strange? Science applies in chorus practice, for example. Science applies. Science applies in home ec. Science applies in shop. If science is to know, and if science is to find out, as soon as Johnny knows the difference between a half an inch and a quarter of an inch, he's learned a scientific fact. Now, the reason I stress this is there are many people who say, here's Bible and here's science. I don't believe it. The more we divorce this material one from another, the more confusion we have. We are a unit personality, like I've been trying to say. We are a unit physiologically, like I was trying to say, and we learn as a unit. When I first went to Eastern Mennonite, 40-some years ago, I was in line at the orientation table. My home minister was in front of me. And they said, "Welcome from Ohio." "Yeah, welcome, welcome." He used to be my roommate, and he was my minister from home. He said, "Dwayne's here to study science, but I want to study Bible." I've never forgotten that, or the tone of his voice, as if Dwayne wasn't quite doing what he ought to be doing. Like there's something kind of shady about studying science. It's not that way. Science is very practical, and it's applicable to many, many things. Did you know that a study of the Bible, study of God, the concepts about God, is a science? Theology. It's a science. We follow certain rules to understand what God has already told us. And if we don't follow those rules, we can make him tell us some weird things. Like the man who didn't want to split wood, you know. "What God hath joined together, let not man put asunder." See, he thought he could get out of that, right? Or the man who said, "Judas went and hanged himself, go and do thou likewise," to his friend. That's sort of a mix-up of the meaning, isn't it? See? But you'd be surprised how many people establish doctrine on the basis of misconstrued ideas. Because they make their own God, then they're back in the religious humanism camp I talked to you about a while ago. If I'm trying to make God, and you know, I think any man with any sense would know he can't make a God, and yet they turn him out like the people down at Ephesus, a dime a dozen. And when something goes wrong in the sales, they fire the salesman. Huh? Isn't that strange? Well, there's a lot of things we could say yet in addition to how God has moved through scientists. For those of you who use the Abeka biology system, look in the textbook at the number of creation scientists that are mentioned. Isn't there a whole column? It's very, very challenging to find their lives and read them. And they, like Ambrose Paré, they applied what they could apply, and God did the work. Actually, learning is an act of God. Are you aware of that? Learning is an act of God. And to apply it in our classrooms, we are builders with Almighty God. "Think not this thy task is lowly. He who made the earth is holy." There is a sense in which every classroom is a cathedral of its own. I was never in the habit of beginning every class with prayer and closing every class with prayer like some schools are. I remember visiting a large Catholic high school, and in the biology class, they were studying the anatomy of the earthworm, but on the bulletin board were all kinds of orange and yellow flames with a big sign, "Pray for the souls in purgatory." Now, how that applied to biology, I don't know, but it applied to their religious indoctrination, I'm sure. But when we face our class, these are God's children. I am God's child. We are there today at his appointment. And if ever you feel as though this child is unnecessary, ask yourself the question, which one of these children would I like to give up? And what should be the circumstance of his passing? A number of years ago, one of our daughters died of leukemia. And I was in a faculty meeting just a week after that. It was the week before school started, the faculty meeting. And one of the teachers complained long and loud about having too many people in her class. My daughter would have been there. So I just asked this other teacher then who was complaining, "Which one of your pupils would you like to give up? Would you like to go by leukemia? automobile accident, stroke of lightning. Well, it kind of broke up faculty meeting. But it's something to think about. Applied science, like all truth, is a result of God working in, through, and among people. You mean to tell me God made that explosion here this morning? He made all the requirements for that explosion possible. Right? You ate your lunch down there. You are burning up the food right now. Did God make the casserole for you? He made all of the components. It was arranged by hands of, I guess hands, not feet or whatever, of people. However it's arranged. But God made it for you. And what's more, He made it for you to use and to do and to be. God bless you. Thank you for the input that you shared with me. And I hope that together we're able to do a better job as teachers than we were ever able to do before.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.